Welcome to our Brave Feminine Leadership interview series, where I get to dig into delicious conversations with global leaders, and I get to ask them about women in leadership, and we get to soak up their wisdom and their perspective on life and leadership. And today I am so thrilled to be joined by Simone Clark. Welcome, Simone.
Hi, Melissa. Great to be here.
Okay, so let me share with the audience who you are if they haven't met you before. So Simone's the CEO of UN Women Australia and has over 25 years of executive leadership experience in global sustainability, international humanitarian development and not-for-profit leadership. Throughout her career, Simone has been a strong advocate, championing and accelerating women's and girls' empowerment, sustainability strategy, integrated campaigns and programs for social impact. Her global experience spans Asia-Pacific, the US and Australia in executive roles encompassing multi-year investment, fundraising, corporate partnerships, communications and brand marketing for organisations like UNICEF, Save the Children, Telstra, the AFL and Mission Australia. Simone, so lucky to have you here with us. And for anyone in our audience who hasn't had the pleasure of coming across you before, would you share with us who you are as a human being and your story? Let's get into your story.
Wow. Okay, just a small question to start off with. Thanks, Melissa. I hope we've got some time for it. I'll try and keep it pithy. So I suppose for people that I haven't met, I am a happily married mother of three, now 20-somethings, who have been obviously a very big part of my life as a working mother. And I have a wonderful husband and partner who has really supported my journey throughout, and we've been able to navigate the globe together. He works in the film industry, so we've been able to forge out quite an interesting life along the way and have had an incredible journey together. But I suppose independent of that, I have also had a somewhat unorthodox and circuitous route to the current role that I hold, although I really feel that all of my experience to date has led me to the current role I'm in. But that's the professional side of me. Personally, I am essentially a pretty happy, outgoing human being. I love music. I love the ocean. I like time out. I find when you are working intensively, it's really important to try and take time out. I'm getting better, I think, at that as I get older, but I'm not sure that I am, because my team often laugh at me and say, well, it's time to switch off now, Simone. So, but I think that is a curse of anyone working in a leadership role, because there is simply never enough time in the day. So I do work and speak quickly. So if I accelerate my my chat with you today, Melissa, please slow me down. I'm also the youngest of five children. I think that's something to do with wanting to get a word in edgeways with two sisters and two brothers and a wonderful family life growing up. So I feel incredibly privileged. A white woman of privilege, which often comes up when I'm looking at the paradigm and the spectrum of equality and rights for women across the globe, and more generally, just in terms of economy, lifestyle, where we have the absolute good fortune to live and be part of. And I am continually engaging with women whose lives have taken a significantly different path than mine, and I am bolstered and encouraged by their motivation and their strength and their resilience. So I think that's something that's really important for all women, you know, that we look to each other and hold each other up and really look at the spectrum of advantage and disadvantage and really work towards a better end game for all of us, not just for women, for men, for families, for communities. Anyway, now I'm going into work speak, so I'll stop myself there.
Okay, let's come back to you. I was having a little laugh to myself. You know, you and I both speak reasonably quickly. So for anyone digesting this via a podcast, don't play it at 1.5 speed. You know, I know sometimes we're tempted to do that, but this won't be one to play at 1.5 speed. So Simone, I would just love to ask you, so many different things, but I just want to kick off, we'll weave elements of your story through this, but I just want to kick off with asking you about your reflections on the recent International Women's Day. Where are we at?
Again, I talk about spectrums a lot and one end of the spectrum to the other, and I think on some levels, we have had significant gains, you know, over the last 5, 10, 20 years, and yet we have seen in the last year significant setbacks. And you only need to look to the situation in Iran, the current situation in Afghanistan, you know, what's happened in the Ukraine in terms of impact on women, and unfortunately, both man-made and natural disasters, you know, with things like Turkey as well. we know that women in those situations are always worse affected. Their death rates are higher. They are more exposed to violence. So I think it's really disappointing in a lot of ways to see that so much great work has been eroded over, you know, decades of work has been eroded, you know, quite literally over the last 2 to 3 years. And that's really disappointing. And also makes you shake your head and wonder why you continue to do what you do. But when you hear the women's stories and you know the challenges that they face, wherever we are, you know, everything from sexual reproductive rights in the US, you know, and in other markets as well, through to, as I mentioned, you know, some of those disaster prone areas and man-made crises, and then add, you know, environmental constraints and climate change and the emergency around climate, all of those things are absolutely exacerbating and impacting women. So unfortunately, we've made some gains, but we've also seen some significant regression in terms of some of those indicators. So that's disappointing on a number of levels. But I'm also hopeful that the momentum is growing. And I think women also finding their voice around a lot of these issues impacting them and are not accepting things that perhaps we might have accepted 10, 20, 30 years ago, whether it's in the workplace, in the community, and or more broadly, internationally. And I think, you know, with the rise of women leadership, both in political representation in this country, even, we have seen a dynamic shift in, I think, the political agenda and the narrative around women and communities more broadly. So, you know, significant gains over decades, unfortunately, also significant impacts over the last 18 months, 2 to 3 years with COVID. Mm-hmm. We've, you know, really had the odds stacked up against us. Humanity has. That's not just peculiar to women, I think.
Mm. So I want to bring this back to you and I guess to your career, because you continue to have a career that that has so much impact in so many ways. And so I'd just love to tease out, you know, a bit about your career. And I think in particular, was there a sort of aha moment, if you like, where you got really intentional about what it was that you were going to do?
It's interesting. So thank you for the lovely comment that you made about, you know, my career and progression to here and having an impact. I think one of the things that I am continually challenged by is the extent of that impact. And, you know, close friends will often say, how do you keep doing what you're doing? And I'm like, well, you know, it wouldn't be so frustrating if we didn't keep doing the same things and expecting a different response. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, humanity's continual approach to look at, you know, to approach the same issues but in the same way and expect a different outcome. So that's frustrating. That being said, you know, I honestly believe it's an absolute privilege to be able to have an impact and have an outcome to your day job that goes beyond profit, that goes beyond producing something. Now, we all produce things and we all create value in different ways. So for me, the value that I try to create is around impact. And so that's been, I think, just intuitively a driving force in my career. As I said, I am not one of those people that have a wonderful 5-year plan of follow it. I am fairly instinctive about opportunities. I also get to a point where I feel I've had as much impact potentially as I can have, and then feel I need to either hand the baton over or move on to potentially have an impact in another area. Mm-hmm. So I think it's that constant desire, yes, A, to have an impact, but also I've had the absolute good fortune of having some amazing roles and having experiences that are incredible and compelling and challenging. And that is also a really big part of who I am, about, you know, put yourself out on the edge and what's the worst thing that can happen, Simone? And sometimes that's been like, whoops, well, not so great, but all learning experiences, right? So you take that through. So I think it's been, as I said, it's been a very iterative, organic, and I know people use those words all the time in terms of my career. And I've had the good fortune also to have some amazing mentors and some people who have pulled me into sectors, for example, the AFL, you know, white woman on the northern beaches, you know, what does she know about football? You know, it's a southern state thing, and why is she the campaign director for a new club in Western Sydney? And yet the then head of AFL New South Wales was talking to me about some of my experience in sport and my work with FIFA and others at UNICEF and the UN, and he saw that they were transferable skills and that all I needed to do was apply that to that different, you know, different environment. But as you can imagine, as a woman walking into a very male dominated industry at that stage back in the mid, you know, 2000s, that was an interesting time. But again, what great experience. I mean, what woman in Australia gets to start a football club? I mean, you know, and be part of that, and the camaraderie and the, you know, that notion of being a team and, you know, on and off the field around football. I mean, I wasn't an AFL tragic by any means, but what drew me to that role was the fact that in Western Sydney, the whole ethos was about the club was, how do we make football a way to bring the community together? How do we create a recreational option, a weekend, a time with kids, you know, everything from Auskick through to, you know, through to the Premier League and AFL, you know, professional league. But so that was, again, I'm like, wow, okay, that's interesting. And yet, you know, I literally had conversations on that role probably for about 18 months before it happened. So I've just been very lucky, I think, and also lucky to have people who have backed me and trusted me to deliver. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, as we all do, but it's really important to have those people in your corner that were, you know, challenged by why you bring in this woman in to do this role who, you know, doesn't necessarily have skills in our core business.
It took a while then for you to make a decision to step into that role. What were you kind of weighing up at the time? I think that will really interest people.
Well, actually, it wasn't me. It was the reverse. It was, I think, the AFL considering whether or not they wanted, you know, a woman in that role. And so it took them quite a while. But I think still at the time, you know, there was, again, conversations with friends and mentors around, okay, Simone, so you've just come back from working with UNICEF in New York. You've been in international development for 12, 15 years. You've worked in not-for-profits and for purpose and impact. And you're going to work in football? Like, that was just like this complete disjoint. But again, the essence for me was, what you do every day is what you do. For me, it's the environment within which you work, and you are given latitude and ability to grow. And I remember a former boss who is still a mentor said to my previous boss, how do I encourage Simone? And she just said, just set her free, let her do what she needs to do, and, you know, she will back you. And so, and that worked really well, because we then worked together for 5 or so years. We're still good friends. And she enabled and gave me that space. So I think as leaders, to be able to be given that space by your line manager or those you work with and around to complement each other is absolutely paramount to your individual success and your team success. So I've been, again, just incredibly lucky that I've had people that, you know, I've also had situations where I have been repressed. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but, you know, felt a little caged. And in those instances, I have opted out because there wasn't the latitude to step in and to maybe shake things up or do things slightly differently. And so I find, you know, formulaic works in certain instances, but again, when you're creating and developing, be it partnerships, be it brands, be it campaigns, that latitude and creativity that sits behind it is really important, and to have that space and time. So again, that was just, I've just been very fortunate to have that, but also know when that fit isn't right and when there's a rub for me personally, and then I tend to withdraw and disengage. And then go, okay, so this is not my optimal operating environment, so what is? And then try to seek that out. Because for me, who I work with and the environment within which I work is far more important than the job that I do, because the job that I do is kind of same old, it just changes depending on the sector or the environment and or the, you know, the objectives of the strategy. So I've just been really super lucky, I think.
When have you felt particularly, has there been a point where you've felt particularly vulnerable in your career? You talk about some situations where you've had to make decisions because of personal sort of rubs.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's probably been a couple of situations, one where I was in a team and, you know, there was restructures going on, and that's never a good place to be for any team, right? So that uncertainty, people don't like uncertainty, people don't like change. In that environment, and in that environment, I think people display probably personality traits and behaviors that are not necessarily inherent to who they are. And so when they start manifesting themselves, you start to question, who am I, and am I either bringing that out in my colleagues and or my line manager, or am I adding to that anxiety? Yes. And I'm trying to be supportive. So sometimes it's a real, how do I look at my own behaviors and in light of others? And often you take on a lot of responsibility for other people's behaviors, rightly so, on your own shoulders, but also sometimes probably too much. So I think it's also kind of knowing what's your go or no-go zone. And I think I've gotten to a situation, certainly in one role, where it was just the operating environment, it was the uncertainty, it was bringing out poor behaviors a little bit, to some extent, like, you know, through COVID there were different people reacting because different people have different stress levels and capability to be able to cope with whatever is thrown at them. So I think that's been a challenge. And then in another environment, I was leading a large team, and for the life of me, I could not understand why there was a disjoint between almost where I was trying to take the organization and the team. And there was a real rub. And I don't think I did a very good job about trying to bring the team with them, with me on that journey. And so I think that was a real learning experience for me. And, you know, it was also quite a personally challenging environment when you are leading a team and you don't feel people are with you, or you've got to battle with them to what seems to achieve what seems obvious to you, or to align behind an objective which seems obvious and part of your reason for existence. When that's challenged and then it became almost quite undermining, then I found that personally incredibly difficult to deal with, and was, you know, obviously a time to move on, walk through that open door, because personally, professionally, attitudinally, behaviorally, it was bringing out the worst in me. And so now I can look back and learn from that, but it's still, you know, when you have experiences like that as well, they still sit beneath the surface. And sometimes even subsequently, you know, years later, things will happen and I will default to that either defense position, or where is, you know, or it will automatically almost trigger a defensive response in me. And so I have to watch that. And again, another learning experience of leadership when it doesn't work, or when, you know, you have challenges. And so that was a real learning curve for me.
Thank you for sharing that, because, you know, I think when I asked you the question before about were there aha moments in your career about getting intentional and things like that, and I hear that perhaps not, they're, you know, not a five-year plan, there's good opportunities that come up and you've taken them, but you have been intentional about recognising when an environment hasn't been, you know, bringing out the best in you. Yeah. And many people, I think, don't do that. They stay...
Well, yeah, I think I probably stayed too long, because I'm also very stubborn, and I was, you know, I really wanted it to succeed, and I wanted to bring the team, but, you know, it just didn't matter what I threw at it, whether it was resources, additional support, we just couldn't get there. And it got to a point where it just did feel like it was disassembling, and then, you know, but I was determined that it was going to work. And I think probably to my detriment, really, longer term, but at least having done that, again, that's a life lesson for me. And, you know, bringing people along on the journey is absolutely core to what any leader needs to do. And we talk about storytelling and bringing people along, but, you know, if your team are with you and walking along beside you or in front of you and you walking behind them and helping them, then, you know, helping them achieve what we set out to achieve, or if there's not buy-in for that, then it's just completely counterintuitive, I think, well, certainly to me and most people in a leadership position, that, you know, but you don't deliberately want a rub with people. Like I like, you know, my family often laughs, you don't like confrontation, Simone. Like I like everyone to be happy. I'm a happy person. I want people to enjoy their work. We work too long. I've had the good fortune of you know, working and having great roles and loving what I do. And I don't, and I'm not the, when I walk in the door, I'm a work person. You know, all my life I've been, you know, sitting on beaches thinking about things and, you know, what could we do? What might it look like? It's part of who I am. It's not something I do. And so when part of who you are gets challenged and what you're trying to achieve, that's really difficult on a personal and professional level.
Mm. Absolutely. I want to think now about when you stepped into the CEO role.
Yes.
You know, I'm all about encouraging women to aspire to CEO roles. I think they're wonderful roles. Can we talk about how it felt to become CEO? Like, did anything about that surprise you, or just let's share your experience?
So most recently, I think in the current role as CEO for UN Women, I don't think at the time the enormity of the opportunity was really, really landed with me. I looked at it and I thought, you know, I do really love being in the UN system. I think it absolutely has value. And so the opportunity to go back into the UN system after being with UNICEF was a great opportunity. But, you know, the shift to be, you know, CEO of, you know, because I've worked in other UN agencies as, you know, managers and leaders, but never with the gig, so to speak. And so that was daunting and challenging and exciting. And I don't really think that it hit me until I was successful in securing the role and I told my daughters. And they were like, wow, mom, that's huge. Like, you know, that's huge. Yes. And I'm like, yeah, okay, maybe it is. And then even now, still, I talk to people and, you know, I was in a meeting recently and someone said, yes, but we've actually been waiting for you. And I said, what do you mean? But not like waiting for me as, you know, the you know, Jesus, but waiting for you as UN Women to almost define the role that you're going to play and that you're going to step into, because they sensed a step change as I came in, because the organization was building on its short history. And I thought that was fascinating because I was like, what really? What do you mean? Like, okay. And then it made me go away and think about that intuitively, we were already planning where we wanted to be and what role we were going to step into, but that there was also a leadership role that was being asked of the organization and by extension myself about the role that we would play in addressing gender inequality in this country. Mm. And I think that was the first time that the impact of and the enormity of that and the responsibility of that, not that it only sits with me and my team, there's a range of obviously actors, but I think that was really a bit of an aha moment where it was, this is a huge role, huge opportunity. I mean, I keep saying to the board, I'm not short of opportunities, I'm short of people to help us. I mean, yeah, we're a small team. But just that energy around what's possible. And I think that's the thing, you know, I've always lived a bit of a what if, what would it look like? You know, that blue sky kind of dreaming most of the time to my detriment. But, you know, that what if question is absolutely on steroids in this organization. And we absolutely have a huge opportunity to really change and shift the environment for women both here and internationally. And that's a huge responsibility, but wow, what a fabulous challenge as well. Incredible. And fabulous to be part of.
I remember getting advice before I stepped into the CEO role, and I also recognised that humbling kind of moment that you just talked about too. You don't feel that weight until you're actually in the role, do you? But it was the question I wanted to ask you about was I had some brilliant advice, and what it was, because I'm sounds a bit like you, lots of ideas, and yeah. Look at things and think, how could I impact that and change that and fix that or whatever. Mm. Exactly. And a mentor of mine said at the time, knowing me very well, said, just pick two or three. You're going to look around and you're going to see so many things you want to do. Pick two or three or you'll kill everyone. What was the best advice you ever got?
I think it was pretty similar to that. Focus, Simone, focus. Because I am a bit, you're like, wow, we could do this, we could do this. And, you know, and that can be fatiguing for those around you, including yourself. I think very early in my role prior to this one, I had a mentor who I spoke to, you know, quite regularly, and he was in the private sector. And, you know, I sort of said, oh, you know, this CEO, I said, all I feel like I'm doing is fixing things. And he's like, yeah, but so I'm like, you know, like everything comes to me to fix. Like, can't people kind of be involved and fit? And he's like, Simone, that's the job. Like, at the end of the day, people look to you for that leadership, and but also give them time to solve as well, because as an action-oriented person, my first, and it's the same thing with my kids, it's like, Mum, this is happening, or this is happening at work. Okay, I'll step in and fix it. Not, but I think for me, the hardest lesson to learn, I don't think I've mastered yet, is holding back and almost leaning out and letting others, because otherwise you then create a bit of a rod for your own back. So let others solve as well. And you don't always have all the answers. I mean, I think ego and other things makes us think we do. And often we don't, because usually your teams know the business far better than you do. So again, it's that sort of time and space to let them also bubble up around and solve for, and staying off emails, because, you know, you tend to jump in and go, okay, well, and be directive. And it's like, no, just sit back, let it play out. And I'm still learning that one, I have to say. I'm not that good at that, but I'm trying.
Well, and that's it, right? Leadership is about continually learning and about self-awareness.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Have you ever had trouble finding your voice in any of the environments you've worked in?
It's funny, I said to some friends recently, you know, we talked about earlier about speaking quickly, and there have been environments where even when I've been training others that I would get up and I would speak quickly and I'd execute quickly because I fundamentally didn't necessarily believe or have the confidence in that what I was saying would be something that people would want to hear. And, you know, that whether that's personal insecurity, being youngest of five, I don't know where that comes from, probably a mix of all of those things. And so for me, it was building that confidence over time. I mean, most people who know me would go, confidence is not your problem, Simone. And I go, yeah, probably right now. But that's fine because that's how you present to the world. But no one hears the voices in your head and the, is this a value? And, you know, I've been at teaching and training in UN environments with people with English as a second language. And, you know, I try to get up there, keep it on time, riddle, you know, go through everything. And people is like, just slow down. You actually have something we want to hear. And I think, again, that was a big learning curve. And a colleague said it to me in a previous role, and she said, what you're taking to the board is so important, Simone. Do it slowly, explain it slowly, because you can and you can articulate it. But when you're hurried, and you know, and a former boss said, you're always hurried. I'm like, that's because I've got a million things to do. And he's like, yeah, well, don't do a million, to your point. Mm-hmm. Just do two or three, which was interesting because, you know, my response back to him was, well, stop giving me more work to do and I won't be so harried. So, you know, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. But, you know, time, focus, all those things that, you know, I think that you just brought up are part of that as well. And I'm not always good at that. And also carving time out for thought and space for yourself. You know, I look at my diary and I go from back to back to backs to, you know, chunking down some focus time and, you know, giving myself reading time, and then that goes out the window. And I'm really trying to be much more deliberate about finding that time for me to breathe and reflect and focus so that I can also be a better leader and be more present for the team. Because when you're thinking about the next meeting and going on, what's happening next, you're not really present for the people who want some time with you or want to explore things with you either. So, yeah, being better about slowing down, taking time, and taking time to plan and prepare. I mean, I love planning, I love strategy, but that's part of it. But actually, again, I think it's part of that bringing people on the journey with you. It's not just about a strategic plan and goals and objectives and KPIs. It's about the conversations. You know, people go, oh, we've finally finished the plan. I'm like, yeah, but that's kind of like that. That's actually not the point. The point is all that other stuff we've done before, because now we're all invested in it. We get it. We understand each other's drivers and what we're trying to do together. So, and that's really important. And when you don't have that, that's when I've found the most rub in teams, where cultures then become, you know, a bit more toxic and there's competitiveness as opposed to cohesion. And so, yeah, I think that's really important.
Let me take a brief pause from listening to the podcast for a minute just to check in and see if the conversation's inspiring any new thoughts or any new reflections for you. I hear so often from people in our audience, largely successful and senior professional women, how much they are craving some inspiration into their lives. I would just love to share with you, if you're looking for some, then come and sign up for our Sunday Inspiration email series. You can find a link in the show notes at the end of the show. Now let's get back to the podcast.
I'm passionate about, well, all leaders, but I'll say women in particular, really getting to understand the financials of business. You know, I think I see it as one of the big gaps of women from getting promoted through to senior roles. They're, you know, less likely to be asked to take on P&L responsibility and things like that. Was it an area that you had to be deliberate about getting experience in as you went through your career?
I think it was, but it was. It's also, I think I'm probably a classic example, Melissa, of exactly that problem and of that challenge, because one of the things that, you know, given my age and sort of, you know, my educational background is I started in, you know, communications marketing, and I was involved in family businesses from the age of like 10. So, you know, settling up the cash register at the end, like, so those sort of fundamentals of that, and then being involved in a family business, I kind of learned the P&L and the balance sheet by doing, but not with any formal instruction. And I think that is, if I'm really honest, I think that's a gap in my current ability. I mean, I've learned over the last 30 years, you learn how to understand and how it works. But I think there are certainly some nuances of financial management that I probably shouldn't be saying this, but in my role, you know, it's still a learning curve. And I'm working with our board, and we have some really, you know, strong financial people who recognize that. And, you know, I'm there to, you know, run the business, manage it, grow the business. And I have a wonderful finance manager. That old adage, you know, if you don't have those skills, make sure the person beside you absolutely has them. But I do think it's probably a gap. And I think it's also a gap because traditionally, or certainly for women of my generation, we have learnt to be managers and leaders on the job more so than with formal instruction and or with formal qualifications, although people, you know, garner those along the way and build their own capability. So I think that's probably also something that undermine some of those core principles of, you know, like if there was a CEO school, what would it have? And it would have, you know, finance, human resource, D&I. And, you know, so that's, I think that is really, that is a gap. And I see it. I see it in some of, you know, some of the teams that I've managed in the past, and the varying degrees of nuance around, you know, even things like we'll have a team chat and people say, great result. That was a great result. And I'm just like, based on what?
Yes.
Okay. Target. Actuals, the variant, even explaining variances. Sometimes people go, well, we set out to do this and we got to here and that's a good result because we hit 80% of target. Okay, but then what's the other 20%? Well, what have we learned from that? And I think there is know, we're all really good at information and preparing and making that case, but that analysis and the insights around numbers and or more broadly around data, for example, are the things that we all could do better. And so when I come across people that are really good in that space, I'm like, oh my God, you're a guru. I want to hang out with you and, you know, just learn more from you, because I recognize that certainly as a gap in my own capability set. And people that do it brilliantly. I mean, I've had some amazing, you know, finance leads and financial controls and COOs that are just, you know, you see them just look at the numbers and it just brings a story to life for them in the space of 5 minutes. So, yeah, I think that is absolutely a skill set that people at my age and at my stage of the career, probably some of us kind of left that off the dance card a little bit, for want of a better description.
And it's you know, the value I see is that leadership is a true combination of people and numbers, right? Like you've got to have all of that people skill set, and you don't need to be an accountant, but it's the ability to marry those two together is incredible. Now let's get then to, you know, gender equality here in Australia. I mean, we're speaking to a global audience, but I'll bring it back to here, UN Women Australia, where you're focused on. I felt a change, and I felt personally a change myself in, I think, how I felt about some of the lead up to International Women's Day this year. So we're speaking 2023. Did you feel any of that, see any of that, hear any of that?
I did, but I'd be interested, Melissa, in you expanding that just a little bit, because I'm interested in what change you saw, because sometimes when you're in it, you can sense and feel things, but I'm just going to turn around, Elizabeth. I'm interested in you, and then perhaps I can respond to that in terms of what are your feelings and what have you experienced in terms
you
of...
You are completely allowed to do that. I'm very happy to answer questions.
Right.
Do you know, we always see more than one theme running on International Women's Day, so that intrigues me to begin with, right? So we have the UN theme, cracking the code, and then we had the, you know, the other theme around and I can't even think what it was called, but it was pictures of everyone hugging
themselves. Yeah,
and I really felt really uncomfortable about the pictures of everyone hugging themselves. And I was invited to speak at a couple of events. I was very lucky to be invited to go along and talk, and I felt really nervous because they had selected a bit of a combo. They weren't just picking one or the other; they were going with both. But they definitely had the embrace in there. And I could have nervously put my perspective out there to begin with, which I don't know why, because I don't usually lack confidence in this stuff, but I was sort of creeping to the table saying, there's not going to be much hugging going on. If you're looking for hugging, I'm not about hugging. I'm all about action, less hugging, more action. And they were like, yeah, that's okay. And then one of the places sort of softened the message a bit that went out, the public-facing message that went out a bit, but that's okay. I didn't really mind that. But then it was interesting because International Women's Day arrived and I saw that rhetoric everywhere was stop giving us cupcakes, you know, let's take more action and not have all of these images of women hugging themselves, because I'm not sure that's going to get us anywhere. And I kind of took this deep breath, you know, big sigh of relief where I thought, yeah, actually I am feeling and thinking the same as a lot of people. So that's what I'm referring to. What do you think? What's your kind of perspective on that?
Well, I think that's fascinating that you've picked up on it, and I certainly sense the same thing as well. And I think to me, what you've just explained is a reflection of the women's movement, equality, full stop, as a movement, because I think women are now at the point where it's just like, okay, enough already. I'm sick of talking about the fact that it's going to take us 300 years to get to gender equality. Enough already, and almost enough, like, let's just stop talking about gender point blank. You know, we had a conversation around leadership and feminine leadership and masculine leadership. Forget the adjectives. It is about leadership, right? So why do we need to genderify everything we do?
Yeah.
Coming from me, that probably sounds quite weird. But just to loop back to you on the theme for International Women's Day is a derivative of the Commission on the Status for Women, which is the largest conference for women that you've never heard of. It happens each year. It is hosted by the United Nations, and I've just literally come back from a spell in New York, where we had for the first time in 3 years a face-to-face version of the Commission on the Status of Women. And that is all about the United Nations determining a priority theme. And the priority theme for this year is to look at how technology is impacting gender equality and rights. So that's where the cracking the code derivative came from for the Australian event. So in my mind, the United Nations and the Commission on the Status of Women determine the theme for International Women's Day each year. Whether that's adopted or not, you know, obviously I'm part of that system and I think that's, you know, the UN owns the day, if you like, for want of a better word, and we should all coalesce around this, you know, this really important aspect of the role that technology, for example, this year plays in reinforcing entrenched biases. You look at AI, you look at, you know, ChatGPT, you ask these, you know, artificial intelligence at what a leader looks like and they'll show you a boardroom full of men. You will ask them what a nurse looks like and you'll get four different images of a woman. So those entrenched biases that we're fighting in the real world are actually being reinforced because the data points that AI draws on are all those same data points that have entrenched bias and misogyny and discrimination and bias built into them, right? So that's a really important conversation for us to have because technology is not the panacea and it's not going to fix everything and it's not the silver bullet. But we do need to look at where we're creating new universes and parallel universes. You know, things like women getting raped in the metaverse, I'm like, yes. What does that even look like, right? Yeah. So as a societal issue, that's what this year's focus was about. And that's why we try and focus on something, and it's a derivative from the UN. I get very frustrated with other organisations and anyone, for that matter, that tries to take IWD and a tagline like whether it's embrace equity or give yourself a hug day and trivialise the importance of what we are all trying to do as a movement for women and girls. So this is where I think that pushback around whether it's the cupcakes, whether it's, you know, embrace equity or, you know, give yourself a hug. Gender equality is not about giving yourself a hug. Gender equality is about a fundamental human right, and that's where we need to couch it. They're the conversations we need to have. And when we trivialize it, it just undoes, again, all that hard work that everything from the suffragettes through to Me Too, through to all of us, are now a little bit fed up with, right? We work with creative agencies and, you know, the team are all female and they're like, do we have to keep talking about this? I'm like, well, obviously, because people just aren't getting it. So I suppose my concern around organisations that are taking the theme or are creating their own theme for International Women's Day is that it undermines global focus on really key and important issues that have been identified by the UN for us to focus on. And they also have the risk of undermining. When I first saw that tagline, I was like, okay, but kind of why? Like, even I don't understand the rationale. You know, it doesn't make sense. And I really feel it trivializes gender equality. And so for that reason, if nothing else, you know, and then last year it was like break the bias or something. We're all doing this kind of, you know, this. And, yes. And it was also that, okay, so take a shot, cross your arms, and that then becomes your D&I kind of statement for IWD. Yeah. Really? Yeah. So I think that's the part that frustrates me more than anything is that where we trivialize the importance of equality, full stop, end of story, we undermine its value and the necessity to keep working on it. So I find that personally, professionally, on a whole range of levels, incredibly frustrating. But I'm fascinated by your response and I'm hearing it more and more for women, which I think is just this general sort of groundswell of like, enough already. We know it's an issue. Now let's fix it. And women are action-oriented, right? Women will get in there and fix things and get things happening and for the betterment of their families, their relationships, their broader community. So that's at the heart of that frustration. Whatever words we use doesn't really matter, but it's that focus and that consensus and coming out of the Commission on Status of Women are these agreed conclusions on, so what's next? So what are we going to do to address that? I went to a fascinating session, which was with a group of Ukrainian women. It was around Afghanistan. And one of the suggestions from one of the CSOs who was leading the panel was, well, here's the thing. If we're denied any rights in Afghanistan, access to school, access to travel, to any of our fundamental human rights, then don't let any of the Taliban travel. Don't let them into your country. Like, shut them down. You know, almost let's flip it on its head and let's create those same set of constraints for them and let's see how they like it. And I just thought it was a really simple, interesting take on what are those actions we can all take. And I think that's the rub that we're feeling. That's the pushback. And there's this whole other conversation around pushing back on the pushback, which is a whole other thing. But the pushback around trivializing equality, and it's awful. I had a friend who sent me a text recently and said to me, she works in a very male-dominated industry, and she said her boss walked in and said, Happy Vagina Day.
Oh, gosh.
And I said, I'm sorry. Okay. So, and we went, and she's like, and she subsequently decided to to change her job. I'm still talking to her about that. But and I'm like, okay, it's 2023. Are we still having those conversations? Are we still like, come on? So that's, it's like where we trivialize it or we go back 30 years and we go back to those old misogynist foul behaviors and monikers and names. And that's when I just go, okay, enough already. And that's when, you know, the anger and the bile builds up. But anyway, so I'm, but what I am heartened by is exactly the reaction that you had. And don't give me cupcakes, give me action. And, you know, the cupcake again is, you know, the emblematic of trivializing it. It's a sweet, it's a fantasy, it's a placate. Let's placate the women. That's not what it's about. It's actually about human rights. And until we are equal, that will always be an imbalance. And so I think that's what everybody is starting to more and more be frustrated with. Sorry, I went on a bit of a rant there.
No, perfect. I'm really looking forward to your answer to my last question. Because I have put the emphasis right now on feminine leadership qualities. And, you know, to explain why, it's because I think we have led with this archetype of what a leader looks like. We're still getting fed the archetype of what that leader looks like through AI and everywhere else. And that style of leadership, whilst we all need to have masculine qualities, that sort of toxic masculine leadership is not serving anyone well. No. Men, you know, women, a lot of women talk about the fact that they had to adopt those leadership traits in order to be successful through their careers. So I'm desperate to take gender out of leadership, but I don't think we can take it out yet.
No, you're right. And, you know, it is two sides of the same coin, because I often talk about, you know, degendifying it, but then I also on the other hand, I talk about we need more women in leadership, we need more female representation, because fundamentally through our DNA, through our genetics, and it's not just about women, we bring a different perspective and a different viewpoint. What I get concerned about, again, sometimes it is the language, and I know that, you know, we've had a chat about feminine leadership versus masculine or being both. As women currently in the workplace, we are the outcome of the last 30 to 40 years of a workplace that has been traditionally geared towards men. End of story. It's been created by men. Look at superannuation in this country, created by men for men, and now we're wondering why women at 65 don't have enough money to retire on, because they weren't included in the design. So when you hear things like smashing the patriarchy and whatever, it's not about smash men. It's actually about let's look at the systemic change that needs to happen to address what is now the current workforce, which is almost 50-50 of men and women. If you add in casualization, you've got more women in the workforce. So for me, it's about changing the operating environment and the attitudes and behaviors in that operating environment, because what we've inherited is not fit for purpose anymore. And so what does that look like? That will need more women in the design. We talk about that in terms of, you know, the digital space. We need more women coding in STEM, because then we will deliver different products, different outcomes, different platforms, and by extension, different attitudes. So I completely agree with you. The skills and the capabilities that women bring, and if you add an intersectionality lens, whether it is your sexuality, your ethnicity, your gender, your background, your whatever that is, your ability, you know, the number of people I've spoken to that work in disability and working in product design and don't incorporate disability considerations into it. For example, we did this thing at Telstra where we actually put one of the senior execs in a wheelchair and took her through the store, and she's like, this is ridiculous, I can't even see the products, how do you expect me to buy it? Like, it is completely designed to exclude me by sheer virtue of the fact that I am living with a disability. So same thing with women, I think. So that's where I suppose I think the other thing too is certain language is loaded. And I think feminist is also loaded. And sometimes that, here they come, the feminists again, they're all, you know, having a crack at the men. It's not what it's about. It's about every dimension of who you are as a human having a value and a contribution. And the current systems that we have been largely created by one version or, you know, one or two dimensions of that humanity. And so we need to add in the other three, four or five, and then we'll truly have an inclusive society. And that's not peculiar just to women. That's peculiar, you know, that covers every aspect. All the work that's been done now with LGBTQI communities and what they're, you know, what does a workforce look like for them? And do they feel comfortable? Mm-hmm. You know, it's all important. That's all aspects of leadership, because you don't lead one monodimensional group of people. We just don't. And in Australia, you know, probably more so than a lot of countries, you know, certainly Northern Hemisphere countries, we have a very diverse culture. So we need to respond to that, and we need to represent that, and we need to create new systems and environments for every type of human that, you know, which is also the tricksy part, right? Because how do you, you know, how do you factor that in? And I know that, you know, you talk to DE&I sort of leaders, and they're sort of challenged with it. But again, it's sitting over in DE&I. It's got to be, and this is a bit like what happened with sustainability 20 years ago. People talked about sustainability, and it kind of sat on the edge, started as PR, and now it's become, you know, embedded to the largest, to the most part, around your license to operate if you're a commercial operation, for example. Similarly with gender, diversity, inclusion, it can't sit over here. It's just a HR, people and culture thing. No, it's not. It's got to be embedded in your product design, your leadership, how you run your business, how we gear the systems. And it's not just in business, it's everything, you know, when you go shopping and they put, you know, there's certain things at certain heights for different kids. I mean, marketers know us better than we know ourselves, yeah. Right? Why can't we apply that same lens to whatever we do and whatever we create for the future? And what's wrong with smashing or changing or building back better something that fundamentally no longer serves us? It's not that it wasn't right in the 1960s or the 70s. Well, you know, some would still question that, but what do we need now? And let's be, all those things we say we were coming out of COVID, be more agile, you know, be able to change, be able to pivot, all those things. Well, then do that with a full, you know, 360-degree view of humanity, gender, sexuality, spirituality, whatever those things are, and design for that future. Because this is the other thing about the whole technology piece, is if we continue to design based on these anachronistic kind of principles and data points and bias, we're just creating the same environment online or in a different, you know, and we're not creating products that, that women want to use or how they will learn intuitively through a different lens. So for me, it's about value add, and it's often this binary proposition or men or women or one or the other, whatever, whatever, enough already. It's actually not about that at all. Equality is really simple. It's about equal opportunity, equity, and the ability to participate and to be able to engage and procure in systems and products and services that meet your needs as a consumer. My needs as a female consumer, as a cisgender woman, are different to a transgender woman, are different to a woman of color. You know, so we need to incorporate those things in. And, you know, even in international development and the conversations we're having in New York, there was a wonderful panel of refugee women who were talking about decisions being made about them and their futures. And there was a wonderful, you know, comment at the end, which is, you know, if it, you know, basically the fundamental principle was you've got to include us in a solution. And, you know, everyone goes, well, duh, but we don't. Invariably, we slip back to these kind of, well, this is the framework and this is how we do it. And they're like, don't make decisions on our behalf. Yeah. Let us be part of the conversation and part of the solution. And that goes to gender programming as well for UN Women. We are ensuring that women are at the core of these programs that we develop and design and deliver to ensure that they are fit for purpose. Otherwise, like, marketing 101, how are you going to deliver something when you don't know who your audience or your consumer is, or their needs aren't considered? Like, it just seems like a no-brainer. So I want to try and decouple all the guffaw of the last 50 100 years of men v women. It's not about that. It's actually about what kind of society we want to live in, how do we create that equity and equality, and how do we ensure that is there for our futures and our daughters and our sons and their grandchildren, because that will just be a healthier, better planet and place to live. And fundamentally, as human beings, I think that's all we can ask for. So
that's my final question to you then, as I swing the feminine back into the conversation. Yeah. So my final question is, you know, yeah. From your perspective, what does brave feminine leadership mean, and does it need to change?
I think brave feminine leadership is women leading as women. You know, I think you mentioned in the past, you know, I was told in the start of my career, well, if you go and play golf, then you'll go and meet the men, and that's where you need to be. And I'm like, oh, I don't really like golf, and I'm lousy at it. And if that's how I have to, you know, if that's how I have to prove my value is to meet them on a sporting field, well, I'm never going to be a rugby player either. So kind of what's the point? So, sorry, I've just gone off on a bit of a tangent there. But so I think that it's greater representation. It's more women involved. It is. And women, I was also had a wonderful experience at a leadership retreat. I think it was with Telstra. Anyway, I was surrounded by a bunch of burly, amazing men who were, you know, linesmen and techies and engineers, love engineers. Anyway, and we're all talking away. And it was, you know, it was one of those sessions where you started talking about yourself, and I became quite emotional. And I was sort of talking about, I don't know, my family or, you know, and then I started crying. And And I went, oh, I'm really sorry. And this wonderful, it's very senior engineer, Leno, really like, no, no, don't stop. We need more of that. I'm like, what do you mean? I just look weak. I'm a woman. And it's like, I'm pathetic. And he was like, no, no, what you don't understand is I'm trying to get more women in my team because you bring a different way of looking at things. You will respond to customers' needs differently. So don't take out what you consider to be weakness. What I see is emotion and passion. And he said, that's what we need more of. And that was just a kind of a tangential thing. But is that thing about leaders, women, you know, leadership is, I think you can read all the books in the world, but part of it is also to your point earlier about your own emotional intelligence, knowing yourself and bringing to the table our womanness, for want of a better word, because that is important. And that's exactly the dimension that we're missing. So brave feminine leadership is, don't cower away from that. Don't be asked to become something else. What did someone say? There's another great quote. Go where you're celebrated, not where you're tolerated. And, you know, that was about celebrate. You know, women are awesome, right? Yeah. I know some of the most amazing humans on this planet are women, right? And I go, yay, team. But we can also do ourselves a discredit because also the number of those opportunities for us competing for certain roles as well sometimes means we kind of pit ourselves against each other. We need to be better at lifting each other up. And I think we're definitely getting better than we were, say, 20 years ago at that. But that brave feminine leadership is don't be apologetic for being a woman. Don't be apologetic for the skills and the capabilities that you bring as a woman to any leadership. And don't assume you have to be someone else or something else, because your leadership journey is and your leadership style is yours. Honed, sure, continue to work on it, continue to learn, but it's yours alone. And everyone's leadership style is unique. And again, if we have this whole group of, you know, monochromatic leaders that are doing all the right things and saying all the right things according to the textbook, that's not why people are inspired by leaders. They're inspired by action and empathy. And I get it. Yeah, I'm with you. I sign up to that goal and I want to be there with you. To me, that's what leadership's about at its most basic. And so brave, feminine, all those things, dial up the womanness of it, because that is an absolute strength. And I think sometimes we continue to diminish that. So I think we need to dial that up.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining our conversation, but also for the incredible work that you continue to do. I personally could have spoken to you for hours, so we may have to do part two down the track, but I loved our conversation today, Simone. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Melissa. It's been a privilege. Really enjoyed it.
And that was the end of another podcast conversation. So thank you so much for listening to the episode today. I often hear from leaders who felt inspired by the conversations and are ready to put themselves first. And so I wanted to take a brief moment just to share how I've helped hundreds of women, just like you, become crystal clear on the exact steps they should be following right now to lead an intentional and sustainable life without second guessing themselves, so that they can maximize their influence and impact. I've put some details into the show notes, and there's a link there where you can find out some more about our signature Elevate and Influence program. While you're there, take the time to sign up for our Sunday Inspiration email series. Have a brilliant day.